Holy Thursday. Thursday faces this thing, cold, gray-headed, like waters, a trembling dome. It is the hum, lambs filled with thorns. The voice does wind, the mighty thunder mind shine, hunger there, beneath them. Little girl boy found. Arm in like arm appear. White nights, pale strays, the wild child, the kissed and couching maid boy, in a golden wolvish crown, the ever wandering vision licks the eyes. Nurse's Song. When the voices are on, and whisperings and laughing, my mind is the hill, the green sun, the children cover the skies. Then the little birds night the sun, disguise and shout and fade. The boy. In the black tree, the child sings of wind, light, the birds. My tree taught me school, took me under, I sit on her little eye. In learning flowers, a space gives, then tree-born beams shower, the cage droops like a wing. Gold buds and plants kiss me, silver fruits in my hair. The sick blossom. Invisible sick, that arrow. Swift worm leaves, the fly's cradle. Hear the dark joy, under green, a pretty secret.
Excerpts from Sam Says Sam by Sarah Torje. Sam to Sam, in soil, in sand, land in love, in water gilled, swimming, weighted, dry, dried out. I roll grains of salt between my fingers. I yawp. I am the potential of an organism. I am the extinction of a species. But earth, in sphere, in space, suspended, marble spin. I held your body and then beach. Waterless. The salt is palpable, is wet in heaps on the beach, in the desert, above, bird, wind holding, leading, the bird glides on air. Bird, Sam, potential bird, Sam, never bird, Sam, Sam with fingers holds the bird. I held your body, Sam, says Sam, I'm holding it for. The universe was smaller once, a dense nut of matter. All bodies embedded in Sam's body, Sam the potential, all states of an organism, before expulsion, before definition, before lines. I lived inside you and touched the fingers to the lining of your body, and maybe we were never divided, and pressure was without skin or separation. I felt the myelin of all neurons, and I was felt within you as a friendly filling, and there were no limits to the space we could make for each other or the love we could make in the compressed atoms of universes, in the pre-necessity of language before there was air for sound. Sam says, let your pain be alive, let it move, let it be moved. Sam, let Sam move with it. Even Earth as it was without railroads was one great flat plain when Sam first walked the whole of it. Sam's inverted joints revert with the globe's great curve. Sam lasts only the space of 1 second while also lingering in Sam's thoughts. Sam exists unrelentingly as visibility itself, an eyelash causing some distortion to view before it is dug from the lid. Don't ask, who am I, Sam? Say Sam until Sam speaks. Say Sam until Sam empties of all but letters and sand. Say Sam until Sam empties of all associated worlds. Sam, say Sam. Say Sam, Sam, until Sam is. Let Sam be equal to flint, chert, silica, sandstone, sediment, dregs, liquid, volume, container, rail, conductor, sound, vibration, elastic, contraction, elition, omission. Let Sam be equal to bone, tissue, cell, membrane, partition, division, branch, bow, hawk, fetlock, pastern, animal, system, body. Let sand be equal to coral, coelenterate, sea, expanse, surface, form, physical, contact, condition, existence. Let sand be equal to wheel, ground, limit, point, flake, tool, hand, end, period. Sam says to let surfaces conduct, to end equally, to be expansive. Systems contract, animals branch, sea dregs. Sam says let limits be contact, Sam says let bodies be coral, let cells be sediment, Sam says let existence be form. The stuff inside the netting, in the floss of tendons, is so much accumulated debris, the plaque of living, a long-legged animal panicked and caught in the tangle, causing Sam to try and fail to flee. But Sam, in stillness, is finding that bones dislocate to allow a freeing, and then Sam, leaving the dross of the nest with sockets jangling and limbs trailing a remembrance pattern in the soft earth behind Sam. Sam, granite stark, the bark of trees, shouts to say Sam, claw pointed, fur cleft, and feathers torn at the quick, as if to say Sam, broken jawed, if hearted, the wondering brain stems like a flower, towering over exposed roots, and says Sam, your pain, gap toothed and slurring, shell scraped and gorted, super mooned and nerved, belongs to everyone. Erotic Wing Beats from a Swarm of Gnats by Sarah Torje. 1. It's a hum deep in the wood, our wings curve toward it. Imagine our lack, imagine our loneliness, all of us. Imagine our feelings, our seeking form fall, our form. We dance, we press into moisture, into skin if we find it, and then move. The song again. We curve our wings, the sun lights through us, through the mass of us, like a shine through a fog. Now at midlife, I was born 2 months ago, I emerged from the egg, the earth changes. If timed, I may see a whole season before frost, before. My death hangs over me, our deaths over all of us, a collective mourning, a collective enlightenment. My whole life is today. So follow the song, make clear an intention, the continuation of life. And what of skin if we find it? Those on the periphery shoot headlong to feel it, moisture, warmth, the sweat of a body. But those overcome, overstay, and stick, wings to human wrist, the body unwanting undoes them. We are fewer every moment. We are many every moment. I will never know myself. But ask anyway, please ask, who am I? My name is Nat. I am insect. My life revolves around water and a hum, the wing beat of love. Will I even know when I find it? We fly together as a cloud, but without so choosing. Search the rotted tree trunks, search the liquefied fruit and lay there, rest there, nest there. To soak in juice and not drown there requires such strength, such will to a future, be it brief if ever. But we're never alone, never lonely. We search and arrive at each other. 2. Someone says, what's the point of a life so brief, so unknown, so haphazard? It's true, my voice is not particular. I could be any one of us. Our desires are similar, linear. There are only a few things, moisture, leaves, or roots, or flesh. At dusk we assemble, trade the voice, trade, give, take, make, our bodies, the swarm, the ghost. This makes you uncomfortable. You think audibly into the cloud, but you'll die soon. To that I say, won't you? Well, we're not to remind you, we're not to haunt. Instead, we flirt. Your hum, our calling, our dance, and your mouth, the source, the vibration of your throat. Are we really fooled, or are we curious? Are you trying to fool us, or are you curious? How could we breach this boundary, the enormity of a species, the enormity of my whole being folded completely into the crease of your thumb's bend? The possibility of my body crushing, blood releasing into your palm without you even noticing, without even a wince. Don't deny that you think of this when you hum. 3. In wood, we are home in displacement. The wood that falls, the ground that gives to it, and our organisms unloved but humming. You hear it, you try to claim it. Don't say that you see. The swarm is called the ghost, the erotic soul of the dead. And inside the haunt, you can find me, internal, fully plural, writing sound.
Halo by Andy Stallings. I move around you easily as around a sudden liminality of pixels in the blank weird of sensation, vision's prismatic density brought near to a threshold of speech and distributing shards of what you will hereafter figure as the sensile universe, each fragment of which displays such tender pattern recognition, such broad partitions of your presumed identity that you begin to shake, your skin develops distance, you are absorbed into a spectrum, swapping one agitated hue for one erased texture, an annual arrangement for an hour of truth, etc., and you produce a deep but intermittent halo of partializing sequence. You place your forearm through a frosted plate glass, and in the whitening splash of aftermath, you emerge as an angle of incidence in a wave's trajectory through matter and time, obverse side of the image of an intersection in which a vehicle crossing after red relinquishes its color and its shape inside the body of another vehicle, and in so doing defines you as a livable facet of the actually astonishing world. Charge by Andy Stallings. The least we can give, we imagine, wanting only to explode the vast activity of being, parcel shifted from hand to hand, hydraulic action, lilting curve of a road. The least and the most we can give is the same irritant back that we've been given, simply to return that which has installed its spine within us, spectral rainbow of the sleeping child's briefly opened eyes, night tilting suddenly to designate the planet. What does it mean to select appropriate powder, to swallow a fuse? What does it mean to ripen around a seed? Therein is not so much space as could hold two hands to their movement, but enough for a wire and the silence besides of a lullaby, my eye to the invisible, bloomed too far down its lash, too early, though sufficiently to shatter my roster of inoculations, and of it a brittle structure such as bone arose, melancholy like an anchor through the veneer of salt, a childhood's conversation with a father is dropped, opaque threshold of knife twists, the self and its development resounding into distraction, never trebling the clavicle and the thigh, but my skin is not right. My skin is not right and will never deliver me. This is the edifice of language, and to blow it all up is only as dark and as bright as what fractures afterward around the charge. The Night by Andy Stallings. I cut ties with the night. I cut ties with the night and sever too the lethal seam of really living night's estrangement of you. You have stitched it through my sternum, distorting the night. I cut ties with the night and laud your gas mask and choir. I laud whatever eats at the gaped dark mouth of night, whatever eats with such disconcerting calm. If I was with you, I'd sever the seam, threading bodies to unknown bodies roaming the gaped dark night. I cut ties with the night. I cut ties with the night, and its dead avenues may glitter to any touch they desire beneath the chemical crush of dawn. Brilliant bandage, savage eye hole, disconsolate crevasse. I hold your bones. Are you here beyond the night? I cut ties with the night and the shovels, the tunnels that fill you, arcades distilling the free scale night from your size. Have I made a mistake? You talk as though testament blooms in your veins, as though narrative somehow has filled you with origins, and your visible skin at minimum is coarse and chapped with it and splits the night. But I'd take your hand, are you here, and exit the night if I were with you. I'd exit night at the speed of night receding into night. Who cares? At the speed of night's retreat from mechanized longing buried deep in the night. Reverently you provoke the night. Who cares? Provoke this corridor, this zone, this city, your carved composite. Are you here? I aim for the seam of you at the center of night. Who cares? I aim for the gaps in night where down desire lines night breaks off from itself, where your body breaks into sores. Who cares? I aim for those thresholds. They could be diseased. Who cares? If infection is in you, who cares? The most extravagant cells, the most lawless musics, the most sensitive dereliction. Let it all fester. Let it all vanish, howling in the direction of yesterday. Who cares? There's no threshold. I'll provoked return from at any point. No body the host of a wound. I'll refuse to enter. Who cares? I have made no mistakes. There's no end of night to which I'll whisper the end without you. The end. At the end of the night, a wound you've unfurled, attracting a crowd. The end. Have I made a mistake? Was it crucial? I cut ties with the night. Who cares? And admit the fertility of its sores into my body. Are you here? I can make my blood as wrong as you want. I can make my blood just like a room you could sleep in. Who cares? I cut ties with the night like a room that has guttered before its emergence, like a room lined with ditches and trumpets and wings, like a room filled with night's great rot and a chorus, like a room where you sleep with three beaks by your side, like a room where death is the light on the ceiling, like a room of aluminum, a room lined with lead, like a room where death's the blue light from the window, like a room where you wake and break from the window as I walk past. To Blank by Andy Stallings. You step outside and collapse. You're practicing the art of recklessness. February, hardly eating, sleeping less. You don't need a theory to transfix you with vision. Clairvoyance can't distract you from radical breath. On Fridays, in whimsical costume, you attend every funeral in the city, and from each, you text me a picture of yourself with the corpse. It's as though grief were a kind of theater. It is. And these weird transmissions broadcast from the cavity of your skull, an image of the future unfurling from the fertile core of the world, which seems for now to be located in your body. It's been years since the alphabet felt like a set of magic ciphers, since ritual made my body a wound, and so on this axis I place a series of thresholds, a scythe and a threshing floor, a deck of cards, a cache of salt, the city's oscillating edge, a horizon, an open vein, a superhighway aimed at the ultra-deep field, and you, seed and extent, deafening spiral, spell. Now why would I ever leave you alone? Given this shimmering adequacy of touch, given this gush and the velocity of its rinse. But if burial by light is what's coming now, it is, wouldn't you rather undress? Wouldn't you rather hold your breath too long to know what that's like and hear in pain's quiet passage into the body something, a column, a dark projecting beam, splinter from this immensity of light? Into my own nightmare, into your roving ceremonial fire, I've introduced that thread I carry, my death, between my teeth. That thread, the cause of the grimace I swallow in a downpour, hauling my ancestry past the ridiculous piles of the fruit vendor and the coconut slicers, elegant water, while the purse hawkers scramble for cover under the bridge and you laugh without delicacy. That thread I carry, my fertility, between two fingers, while I lift my fork to introduce into my body fig gnocchi, prosciutto, burrata, while I plunge my mouth enthusiastically into your vagina. You have woven it into a pillowcase embroidered with bulls and goats walking in an autumn thunderstorm, and I don't even care. I wasn't born to unravel needlework. That thread I carry, my protostar, between I and I, just the thought of hydrostatic equilibrium makes my elbows revolt. My throat, my larynx and coccyx and lower intestine, but forward, forward, my knees of all things, and my arches, but how will I stand? All separates, nothing convenes. I've grown through all your spirals, I've centered your rings, and this must be it. This must be the instant of main sequence.
Five Introducers at a Public Reading for Sid Vicious and Gary Oldman by Forrest Roth. A very good evening to you, and you all too. I would like to welcome Sid Vicious and Gary Oldman to your public reading, except this reading is not actually happening, but is instead a poor representation of one in your mind, as well as in all of the other minds in attendance. Sid Vicious, as you all well know, was the famous bassist for the British punk band The Sex Pistols, despite lingering questions to this day as to whether he could actually play the bass guitar, possibly or very likely drove the band to break up in the middle of a disastrous American tour, possibly or very likely killed his American lover, Nancy Spungen, at the Hotel Chelsea in New York City, most definitely died before seeing trial, and assuredly was the featured subject of the 1986 movie Sid and Nancy, which is like your famous sister's most favorite movie. Sid Vicious was played by Gary Oldman in the film, an actor who is generally regarded as being a famous, talented, and anecdotal gentleman with a violent alcoholic past. Sid Vicious, a violent alcoholic himself, won no awards in his lifetime, but Gary Oldman has won many awards for his violent alcoholic acting style, including for playing a violent alcoholic Sid Vicious in Sid and Nancy, who may or may not have killed Nancy Spungen. Though neither of these men will be present or speaking to you directly in the conventional and contrived sense, I am very glad to have both here this evening all the same in your mind, as well as in all the other minds in attendance. They will be of great help as you mourn the untimely, anticipated, but not anecdotal death of your famous sister in the city. But not yet. Let's give our next introducer a big welcome, shall we? Applause. Dear not happening reader, once I wanted you beginning. You wanted you all to begin, and you all wanted to begin a story about a person like Sid Vicious or your famous sister, someone not at all close to me, yet whom I detested and would learn to resent with a seething intensity, my emotions disguised under convention and contrivance and a general awe of my being placed before him or her. I would then be introducing a subject of the first and highest order, unlike the previous introducer, and become another storyteller with a mastery of a subject enough to put it in the mind's eye and immediacy of my audience, which you all say we are fully due and accorded. An audience is our birthright. our natural expectation to the use of function, our very existence. Even the Puritans knew that. Now everyone forgets that they must be an introducer until a Gary Oldman enters their life with a violent alcoholic Sid Vicious who becomes the fascination of a famous sister, in this case yours. Remember, I'm not responsible for anything which follows. I'm attempting an introduction because your famous sister, despite her apparent fame, needs introducers herself, and they are as well-deserved as the three lukewarm meals prepared by your civil servant parents in their upstate home when I visit, who will not even speak her name at the table for fear of ruining my appetite in your presence. As an introducer, however, my appetite cannot be tamed by the absence or presence of names, but, most likely American audiences, the novelty of them to our lives when they are introduced to us, with which we play with vicious intensity and aberrant self-denial. We know our lives would be empty without names, especially the famous ones. If I deny mine to you, you may slowly grow to hate me in my life as it opens in front of you, assuming it ever does. But as an introducer, it is not my name you are concerned about, but my subjects instead. And my subjects instead is the withholding of every judgment you place at my feet. If you could see them, we never care about a narrator's feet, only his or her hands. All I can say is, every once in a while, someone reminds the world that even Jesus ate at the tables of prostitutes. To the members of the perpetually seated audience. Instead, I think you will agree, is the best possible thing I can do for you. Instead is the greatest consideration America ever invented. Instead of being an introducer, we could be Gary Oldman. And often we are Gary Oldman, the product of a violent alcoholic household, which was your instead, away from the calm upstate civil servant household, you and your famous sister watching movies with Gary Oldman in them, as well as with Molly Ringwald and Tom Hulce and all the other famous actors of the 1980s she knows, before she is discharged and judgment withheld about her long enough so that she could walk through the door, out the building, and into the self-injurious city. A city, any city, is filled with millions of plate glass doors today. Many of them are automated and thus are extremely difficult to deliberately walk through, but a majority are still of manual operation, requiring on occasion a friendly stranger's gesture to hold it open and observe what is known as good etiquette. No one ever held a door open for Sid Vicious in real life, and there were no automatic doors at that particular time, if I am not mistaken. It was not an accident, then, that the real Sid Vicious and Gary Oldman as Sid Vicious and Sid and Nancy walked through a plate glass door, distracted by someone calling out what he thought was his name, but an act of revolt against civilized society's true lack of etiquette, or, I should say, the pretense of etiquette, which constitutes any building in any city. But I, obviously, am not Sid Vicious, nor am I Gary Oldman playing Sid Vicious. I am someone who holds and has held open plate glass doors for a countless number of strangers who I never see again as they disappear in etiquette into the vast, unknowable building of Gary Oldman's America. Your famous sister is somewhere in one of these buildings where someone, maybe or especially a gentleman, holds open a plate glass door for her, carefully, firmly, but not anecdotally. This gentleman, all the same, follows her inside. He is entranced by the sour look she gives him because she has been thwarted by etiquette and is now inside the building without going through a plate glass door like Sid Vicious, lost, not wanting to be there under these conditions. Since he knows he belongs in that building at least, and knows it very well, he feels he has a certain claim to its purpose, its outlay, its overall aesthetic harmony of making someone not feel lost, and so asks her where is she going and could he be of any assistance in finding her destination. Instead of answering, she ignores him completely, fully, but rudely, and she looks for a staircase, finds it, begins making a long ascent up 18 flights, despite the working elevators being the more preferable ascending option, which strikes him as odd because gentlemen will take the elevator with gentlewomen. He wonders if she is not really a gentlewoman, but someone like Nancy Spungen instead, the kind of instead woman he has never known but perhaps had thought about after turning off Sid and Nancy halfway through because the movie disgusted him and he had not felt the deep appreciation of Gary Oldman that he does now after a long acting career of winning many awards for many notable roles which did not involve saving women, especially prostitutes and Puritan adulterers, until fairly recently. You know, the one where he bounds up the stairs at the end of the movie to save the woman he loves, even after finding out she was selling herself to other men, before she threw herself off the building because she believed firmly, truly, but not effortlessly, that no one, particularly whoever Gary Oldman was playing, loved her, and that she would never be anything more than a prostitute in a building in any city. You know, that one. Not the psychotic, murderous DEA agent versus Italian pedophile assassin for hire one, the other one. Though that movie works too, because often you will never know for certain who should save you from adolescence. May I ever have your attention, please? The real Nancy Spungen was known to enter buildings in a conventional way because it was very unlikely a gentleman or gentlewoman would hold open doors for her in public. Your famous sister already differs from Nancy Spungen in this respect. Your famous sister, unlike Nancy Spungen, has been to Mann's Chinese Theater to put her hands in the famous concrete handprints and would have gone to the Getty Museum in Los Angeles if it actually existed outside of Gary Oldman's mind. But like Nancy Spungen, your famous sister shows a preference for stairs, especially when they lead to the rooftop of a building where most people seldom go when they enter a building. Your famous sister goes where most people do not. That is why, of course, she is famous, other than starring in movies with the famous American actors in the 1980s. Of course, some people become famous in America for falling into a coma, others for jumping off a tall building, but this is not the sort of fame your sister seeks, I know, because your sister means to rearrange the social order of American etiquette, as Sid Vicious would have surely done had he not killed Nancy Spungen at the Hotel Chelsea, accidentally or otherwise, and then OD'd later, though perhaps he would have failed better to merely stumble off the roof of a tall building after taking a final swig of vodka, a theory your sister may be willing to consider since she has no idea what is she is doing now in this building. It has been said, or at least intonated by many Nobel Prize-winning authors, that a gentleman will not let a gentlewoman fall to her death, much less deliberately walk through a plate glass door. Because he never finished Sid and Nancy, this gentleman is unsure of that, however. Perhaps some people deserve to walk through a plate glass door or throw themselves off a tall building, though no Nobel Prize-winning author has ever suggested this. To be sure, there are many people in America who deserve to walk up 18 flights of stairs, even when the elevators are working, but the gentleman is not certain whether your sister is one of them, even if she bears some resemblance to Nancy Spungen. He himself bears no resemblance to Sid Vicious or even Gary Oldman as Sid Vicious or even the real Gary Oldman who was raised in a violent alcoholic household. He is a gentleman following your famous sister up the stairs quietly, carefully, but not constructively, making sure that she does not see him, but at the same time, she is aware that someone else is indeed in the stairwell and may possibly, potentially, but not innocently, follow her up to the roof where something anecdotal may happen, but in all likelihood, nothing will happen, which is what usually happens in most American buildings that you and I never seem to avoid, as well as what usually happens to Nobel Prize-winning authors who visit Niagara Falls or stay at the Hotel Chelsea. To those who do not deserve to die. On this special occasion tonight, I am so humbled and very pleased to introduce you to the two people who have never thrown themselves off the rooftop of a building, one who belonged in the building in question, and one who did not in the conventional and contrived sense of belonging somewhere, namely of having a building, anticipate your famous sister's presence. This is a strange thing to consider, but we must consider it all the same because I am introducing it to you, and without the introduction, you would have no idea what I am talking about, which is the only unacceptable development when speaking anecdotally. You and you all must know who is being dealt with here, because how will you sit still otherwise and not want to walk through a plate glass door without hurting yourself? You will sit still only when the one who makes the introduction is finished with the introduction and lets us watch two people who do not know the other throw themselves off a building because they could never walk through a plate glass door in our reality of etiquette, which does not belong to Sid Vicious or Gary Oldman as Sid Vicious. But you will soon learn that Sid Vicious does not introduce our reality because it is Gary Oldman who is a building we must walk through, even if, like the gentleman, we turn off Sid and Nancy halfway through because we are disgusted with the fictional counterparts of Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen, or the real-life counterparts we ourselves could become if we get the introduction of a gentleman who follows your famous sister to the roof of a building he works at and feels impelled to save her only because he has to save himself in the process, lest he follow her off the rooftop. At the very least, if he survives and she instead falls, it will make a good anecdote, he thinks. He starts wondering whether your sister is in her right mind and if she is anything like the real Nancy Spungen, someone who is not a gentlewoman but perhaps did not deserve to die, even if she deserved to climb 18 flights of stairs while the elevators were still working. And to make absolutely sure of this fact, he talks to your famous sister out of an imminent suicide pact, walks down 18 flights of stairs, rents Sid and Nancy at her recommendation from the last remaining video store in the city, returns to his apartment with her, and decides to watch the second half of the movie turning to your famous sister sitting next to him on the sofa with voluminous tears in her eyes during the final implied afterlife reunion and the end credits, and saying, "You know, you didn't really deserve to die."
Sitting Indian Style, Giving Birth by Carla Faesler. Translated by Sue Burke. What really sets me off is that the sun makes me kneel probing like a dentist, digging out roots. I am split on his hooks, humbled. She rolls across the apartment floor, kneels before her. Her husband hugs him. His knees press on her belly. Rejection roars like a hurricane. Headstand in a lotus flower. Her thighs watch the moon close its only eyelid. Neighbors ask about the anesthesia, antiseptic containers of progress, flattened. They drive into a tempest, the sharpest mind, closed, perhaps sleeping. So, a whirlwind is released by a wink, numbed. I recall Diego's blue-green figures in the arrival of Cortes, his formless swollen knees, remembering key people informed. They put the child in the eye of the storm, and he spoke from the first day, with his eyes innocently pointing. The center of attention, torment from. The snow outside fell faster, a shroud. We watched it together. Outside, we were looking in. All around, together. My boy, my dearest, I told him, I wanted to weep when I saw you. I saw you. And he knew which part of me meant nothing, and knew part of me.
Hero Pose, Virasana by Catherine Sowerby. All I really know is the sun scratching through my jeans at the knees like dental hooks, Espantapahara's arthritic roots. She rolls on the wooden floor, kneels before her husband, embracing his legs, her stomach tightening. No heaving, howling hurricane in her head, she sits in lotus. Her thighs face the moon, its blinking eye. Why copy next door's stupor, their sterile containers and weary progress? I remember descriptions, the colour of Diego's bruised and swollen knees. The child was the eye of the storm, and spoke from daylight with bright, upturned eyes. In Lutetia, the snow outside sped up. The umbilical cord lay twisted like wet socks and salamanders. Child, my darling, I wanted to mourn when I saw you, and he knew then how much of me was worthless.
Cuchillo by Paula Abramo, translated by Lucy Greaves. It wasn't clear if they were glorifying or recording themselves or just drooling, but they were, in any case, stupefying. So, at first sight, the winding alleys of Lexico City. I, first of all, lived in a house called Cuchillo. The word Cuchillo drooled at the edges, the brand new tongue poked out through the fresh cut, licking soft fat and milk and games in bed from the corners. It was a house made of silver, with blades that recorded, crawled, drooled in a room at 7 p.m. in that neighbourhood called San Miguel Chapultepec. It was a cuchillo. It wasn't a curved knife. It was a cuchillo. It wasn't a machete. It was a blunt breakfast knife. A cuchillo for spreading honey on bread, but it cut the first word I said in another tongue. It was a serrated blade. The word had minute teeth. It cut like a plough marking the boundaries of a piece of land. On this side of the wall is cuchillo, but it's not polite to wield the cuchillo when others are around. On that side are the streets and their dandies and their Indians, and the real cuchillos, the knives of this world, but the cuchillo stays at home. It is the house, the book on the shelf, the bedtime story, cut by the cuchillo, by a wall of silence, the cuchillo buttering our daily bread.
My room's wall. D.M. Adirabigbe. When my grandmother shouts with husk of cashew in corners of her mouth, I shift my bed closer to heaven. I see God's face every morning. On the wall of my room, Damascus crumbles. Morsi loses his tongue into the cannons of the army. Egypt enriches the Red Sea with red water dripping out of the dead screams. A train in Quebec rides over 15 thoughts into forgetfulness. How about the other 35 voices that go AWOL? Beirut and Kabul are founded on the same day. Do not ask me to elucidate that to you. Ask the geniuses who made explosives that have left many bodies burning righteously, like churches set ablaze by opinionated opposites of the Christians in northern sphere of Nigeria, in my backyard. My backyard is simmering in the hands of Boko Haram. God, this morning I come, admonishing you to bless me with chronic blindness when I turn to the wall of my room. Dark Odes, D.M. Adirabigbe. On April 15, 2014, 234 girls were abducted from Chibok Government Secondary School in Borno, Nigeria, by a terrorist group, Boko Haram. At the time of this poem, the girls are not yet found. 1. The morning rings at the entrance to my dream. My eyes open like a twin gate. On the screen, a line of numbers dances with my sister's name. Her 12-year-old voice wavers. Her skin is starving from my palms. How breakable a young heart is once the world becomes their own. 2. My radio spurts confusion into the morning. 234 young voices plucked out of the day's eyes with guns and grits. Their cries stuffed inside our agape mouths. Voices learning how to shape the future into sizes of their hearts. In Borno, chalkboards of their empty classrooms are filled with dirges. Below the moon, drifting above their huts, odes, written with parents' mouths for the girls slipping out of their bloodlines.
Three poems from the Spillo Cycle by Colin Dodds. Spillo eludes his engine. That white, hot, unreasonable core, made sick by food, repulsed by beauty, snickering at sex, impossible to comfort, failed by ideas, disgusted at having been teased into dubious existence in the body, in the senses, under the scrutiny of petty consciousness. It is Spillo, but not his friend. Every small escape it can win destroys him a little and makes him hungry for more. The sun is a witness protection agency. Under its watch, Spillo can pretend not to hear when called by his real name. The day clatters past with vodka drinks, men gathered around a dice table and orange prescription bottles. It's a prison made of freedom. Creation rising up only to say that no, it wasn't looking at nothing. The knight is in appeals court. Spillo's testimony is overthrown there. The moon sets his enemy free. Three poems from the Spillo cycle by Colin Dodds. The audience for Spillo's engine. With a wrath and rationalization and a disdain for the way basic human needs latch onto and subvert every waking moment, Spillo's engine sings on with a breath of burning motor oil. The lukewarm lean in to hear the curses, to cluck at the shabby clothes, lap at the rage and absoluteness of a heart eating itself out, and mostly to hear the thrashing, horrible songs of their own hearts from a safe distance. Three poems from the Spillo cycle by Colin Dodds. Spillo undercover. Spillo overheard the grand design back in April when he was undercover, posing as a ceramic hobo clown. His styrofoam cup was a bottle opener, his belly was a lamp, and his face was a knife. Spillo would sleep and sing songs when you rubbed his crotch. He was only $14.95, and shipping was included.
Tom's Secret Life as a Horse by Jay Merrill. Tom is a city worker who has this other persona as a horse. He doesn't know how it happened, but the horse just kind of appeared one day when he was sitting at his desk in his office on Threadneedle Street. Now it's here to stay. You could say the horse is his other half, his secret friend. Since taking up with the horse, things have been quite different in his life. He used to be serious. He used to be a workaholic. At weekends, a stay-at-home. Now that's all changed. And the horse is unpredictable. This is frightening, but fun. Friday's E for escape, for ecstatic release. Everybody in a routine has to have a way of getting out of it from time to time. Getting out of time. On Friday nights, he's free of everything. But the horse in him gets a funny feeling. What you might call a nasty feeling. Friday is the night you're allowed to be free. Every Friday. Every Friday? Hell, he doesn't like that. It's the opposite of what he's looking for. The horse in him believes in free choice. He's a bit of a rebel, a questioning animal. But wait, Tom says. Wait a minute. Can't you? Damn it. Arguing with himself as usual. It's you that got me into this Friday night is freedom mentality in the first place. I never used to look at things in that way. The trouble with the horse is that it's always in two minds about everything and is changeable with a capital C. Tom never knows where he is. Right now, the horse is totally switched off and just can't hear him. The horse isn't a good listener, it must be said. Tom shouts out loud to get his point across. I love Fridays and it's your fault! Friday night is clubbing night. Friday night is ecstasy night. Clip-clop. Clip-clop! The horse takes his medicine. Feels like dancing. Tom feels like dancing. A harmony of purpose for once. A Friday night to die for. Life is really happening for them. They've arrived at the weekend. It's the weekend which makes the everyday worthwhile, makes it bearable. Tom gets stuck into the dance. His head is racing. His head is a burnished bright thing, strangely alien. He sees it glowing like a fireball through the feet as they dance. Should be on his shoulders, firmly fixed there, but it seems to have fallen somewhere along the way. It seems to be somewhere else. His head is furry with two pointed ears, a white blaze down the nose. It's a lantern. It's a thousand flecks of light. It's gone altogether. Come back! Tom sees the meaning of E. It goes, E. Inside his brain it goes, E. He squeals with the voice of the horse. A quaver in the middle somewhere. A wiggly line with dimension. A high-pitched whinny. A horse, of course. What else could he be? The horse is him. He is the horse. He's in love with himself now. He's a gorgeous palomino. Consider that slinky silver tail. Dancing on the floor, his feet clamoring for more than he can take. C is for clubbing. More than anything he can take. E for E. E, more E. Give me water, the horse calls out. It's a night of early hours. Monday lunchtime, going down the tapas bar, Tom and a few pals from the office. They sit on stool-like seats around a fish-shaped table. Little dishes are spread along the scaly top with bits of this and that. Tom is sticking to aubergine and spicy potato, but the whiff of cooked meat gets into his nostrils, makes him gag. His mouth makes a puckered, throwing-up movement, but he controls himself. They're talking about the weather, his subject. Rainfall, he says. Relief or orographic. Raises a laugh. He seems to have made a coded sexual illusion, and he tries to laugh too, experimenting with being popular. There's a gravyish smell in the air he's trying to unthink. It's unsettling his secret friend, the horse. The horse says, "Get me out of here!" Tom ignores this inner demand, tries staring at the wall to keep himself steady, because he can feel his feet moving. His feet are kind of tumbling forward, right there under the table. They're making little running motions. He tries to stop them, tries keeping his eyes fixed on the wall, starts telling a joke he didn't know he knew. Everybody laughs. He'd no idea how easy it is to be funny. Part of him's enjoying himself. The other part is desperate to run away. Somebody's offering him a dish of meat. "Oh no, get it away from me," he's saying inside, or the horse is. Sometimes Tom hardly knows if it's himself or the horse that's doing the talking. The wall he's fixed his eyes on is starting to rock a bit, strange thing, as if it's going to fall forward right on top of him and going to crush him. "Help!" It started to shimmer as if he's seeing it through a film of water vapor. Clouds are forming in front of his eyes. The clouds are about to burst. There's going to be a storm. He jumps up suddenly from the table, and one or two of the little dishes tip over the side, go crack onto the tiled floor, ooze juices. Distantly, through the low-lying cloud formation, he hears screams, shouts, the click of feet running across the tiles. But he's up and away. The wall's not going to hold him in, rain or no rain. Tom darts up the steps to the street, and then bolts down Fish Street Hill in the direction of the monument, takes a sharp left on Lower Thames Street, going as if the devil is at his heels. Devil? Tom doesn't believe in any devil. But the horse does. Bumps into a wall, falls, cracks his head on the floor. There's blood. The horse smells blood. Drives him wild. Wild! They go careering into traffic. Tom's wondering what he's going to say when he gets back to the office. Tell them he was having a fit? Tell them it was the food? Tell them he saw something terrible? Tell them it was the horse, not him? No, not that. They'd think he was a loony. Doesn't want to give them the wrong idea, does he? He gets back to the building, cleans his face a bit, looks in the mirror. Could be worse. Still doesn't know what he's going to tell them, though. He walks through the general office to his loose box. What he wouldn't give now for a nice bit of straw to crash on. But he warns himself he'd better drop that train of thought right away. A couple of the lunch crowd look in on him. Seems they think he was on something. He gets a few winks here and there. Doesn't have to say a thing. Increases his rising popularity, if anything. Man of mystery. The horse gets Tom into situations. But luck is riding on his side.